one last bit of housekeeping. Alison and Kelly, can you just say a sentence into your mics for me for the levels?
Testing, 1, 2, 3.
There once were two husbands disappointed by eggs.
Oh, nice. Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction, books, reviews, and the odd bit of idle gossip. I'm one of your hosts, Kirsten McDermott. Sitting to my left, everyone's sitting to my left actually, but sitting to my near left is your other co-host, Ian Mond.
Hello everyone, both listeners and audience. You're
yes,
going to mention that, weren't
I will,
you?
I will mention that. It's my turn to host the show. Stop it. Sitting to my next to near left is one of our very special guests for the podcast, Alison Goodman. Hello, Alison.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
She's actually not. She really isn't.
We know what happened last night.
See how reflexive that is to say I'm good when we know you're not.
Well, I didn't think it was germane to go into the amount of martinis I had last night and why I didn't get up till midday.
Oh, I think it's germane.
And sitting on my very far left is our other very special guest for the podcast, Kelly Link. How are you, Kelly?
I'm much better than I hear you are.
That would not be hard at this point. The reason we have Kelly and Alison as our very special guests, as our live audience will already know, listeners, is that we are recording at the Continuum Speculative Fiction and Pop Culture Convention in Melbourne. And Kelly and Alison are guests of honour of the convention, so we thought we should have them on our podcast as our guests as well.
That's right. And are you glad to be here?
We're very glad, aren't we, Kelly?
Yes.
Are you nervous? Because we're pretty intimidatory. That's not a word, is it?
Intimidatory?
Yes, that one. Yeah. Yes, thank you, writer person. Yes.
Cowering.
Yes, you should be, because, we're not talking about your books, which is, I suppose, a help for you guys, because we may not have liked your books, and that would be really bad, wouldn't it? Yeah. You were going to ask the questions, Kirsten. It wasn't going to be me because you knew I was going to say something stupid like I just did then.
I know. I was just letting you have a little bit of leash.
You didn't bring the stick, though. Everyone, you know what? The whole convention, and actually throughout my entire life, there are people at work that ask me, is Kirsten going to bring the pointy stick? Is there going to be a pointy stick at the Dipmo Awards? There's no stick. You didn't bring a stick. There's no stick.
The pointy stick is very shy. She doesn't like to leave the house.
Okay. There you go. But it does exist.
She's
it's a real thing.
She's agoraphobic.
For Alison, Kelly, you may not be aware, but apparently I say inappropriate things now and again of a racist, sexist, anti-Semitic nature, and Kirsten feels the need to hurt me. With a piece of wood that she found in her backyard that's all yucky and disgusting and got quite a point on it. And she's now got also a squirt bottle, which she uses...
That's for the other podcast.
And really, that's for another podcast, but that has been threatened a couple of times.
What, you mean this one here?
That's because Ian sits too far away from me on the other podcast and the pointy stick won't reach, so the water is...
She has got me a few times between the eyes. Hilarious. Anyway, enough about me. Kirsten, do you have any questions for our guests?
Yes, I do. I do. Because, yeah, this is the podcast, so I might repeat some stuff that the people at Continuum would have heard if they went to either of the guest of honour conversations. But obviously the listeners haven't been that lucky, so we might cover some old ground. But, Alison, I'll start with you as you are closer to me. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
That's good. You have a new contract for a series of very exciting books, I hear.
Yes, I've got a contract with Australia, Canada and America for a trilogy. It's set in Regency times, can be historically accurate, but it's got a supernatural element, so not that historically accurate, really. It's first book's out due 2014.
Oh, so we've got a little bit of time to wait.
A little bit of time. There'll be a pre-runner short story in an anthology next year.
Oh, very nice.
Have you actually written the first book?
No. No.
Well, you sound really confident, though, so I thought you would have had it already written, shelved away.
This is where she sits primly and says, it's in development.
Okay. So, you got a title?
Yes, Lady Helen and the Dark Days Club.
Does that mean it's going to be a bit dark?
Indeed.
Ooh.
Yes.
Okay.
As dark as I can go because I've got that natural bent to be a bit dark. But, it's going to be a romp. A dark going to be erect. In Regency gowns and a few bonnets.
And the odd corpse just to flavour it up.
And a large bloody knife.
Yeah. You sound a little too excited about this.
Yeah, I'm so excited about it.
And I believe you've just had one of your earlier novels has just been republished or is about to be republished.
About to be republished, yeah. It was originally titled Killing the Rabbit.
Yep.
It's my speculative crime thriller, and it's going to be republished with Clandestine Press and also as an ebook through Amazon called A New Kind of Death.
Mm-hmm. See, I didn't know about that book at all, so I've obviously been following your career really closely. and that sounded really awesome when Jason described it to me in Kirsten's room. Mm. Not relevant, but when it was described to me, it sounded like a really interesting... Was it about a hitman trying to kill eight women?
Yeah, look, it's the speculative premise is that a small number of women throughout the world can resorb their own fetuses at will. And
say that again just so I get that, because that went through my brain very quickly.
So the premise is that a small number of women have a mutation that enables them to do what rabbits can do in times of stress, which is to resorb their young in utero. And what that would do, in my warped imagination, is that would put the contraceptive market in quite a disarray if that became a mutation that spread throughout the population. And so their pharmaceutical company has decided that this mutation must not spread. Thus, Trojan Carmichael, aging assassin, gets sent onto the job of tracking down the rabbit women of Australia.
It's a very nasty, vicious little book.
Yeah, it's sly. It's got sharp teeth and elbows and it's dark humour.
It's not one of those books where Trojan, lovely name, falls in love with the first character and then doesn't end up killing any of them.
Oh, no, no, no.
Okay.
No, it's a very nasty little book. Yes. I'm really, really glad to see it's getting new life again.
Thank you.
So that's awesome.
It's one of the, truly a book of my heart. I had the idea for it when I was 12.
Wow.
Yes. You had that idea when you were 12?
Yeah. I was reading Watership Down.
That's right.
You have a very, very warped imagination if you get that from Watership Down.
So, yeah, that's how my mind works, people. And I kept it, it was one of those little gems that I kept throughout my teenagehood. And it was really kind of when I started to learn that writerly way of saying what if, what if. And when I was 19, I turned that what if into a story. But I wasn't quite ready to write it then. I wasn't mature enough as a writer. So then I went and wrote Singing the Dog Star Blues, which is my first novel, and then I felt I had enough craft to tackle A New Kind of Death.
Excellent, excellent. So for the next few years you're going to be ensconced in the trilogy.
I am. I'm going to be ensconced in the Regency period and my Regency wardrobe. I do have one now. I've got corsets and dresses and bonnets and no, I don't write in them. I just dress up in them occasionally and flounce around.
You think that's less weird than that?
Okay. Maybe not.
Is that a requirement if you do a Regency book, you go buy bonnets?
I made my own.
You made them?
I made my own bonnet. It took me 6 hours to make the first version of it, 6 hours to pull it apart because it was crap, and then 6 hours again to rebuild it.
Okay. Can you show me how to do it? Because I'm real interested. Bonnet making, something I'm into.
I don't think you're telling the truth there.
No, I'm lying. Of course.
And Kelly, those of us who went to your conversation with Kate Eltham on the weekend would have heard that Holly Black is now threatening to tie you down until you write a novel.
You know, I think she's just going to sit next to me and look at me with her enormous eyes.
She can be very intimidatory.
Yes.
Well, Jonathan Strahan is in the audience, and Gary have been saying on their podcast a million times until it gets, very repetitive, that you're getting slowly to that point where you're writing longer and longer work that a novel can't be too far away. Would you agree?
If Holly Black has anything to do with it, yes.
But
I would be very happy to for, the next 20 years, right? stories of between 3,000 and 12,000 words.
That's what I was actually going to ask you. Do you yourself, I mean, there's a lot of pressure in publishing to write novels as opposed to, you know, because that's where the career is, that's where the slightly higher income is. But do you yourself really want to write a novel, or you just said you'd be happy to write short fiction?
Well, the thing about writing short stories and you know, somebody coming to you and saying, I really like your short stories, when are you going to read a novel? Is, well, if you like the short stories, you know, shouldn't you just want more short stories? There are things that you can do in a novel that you can't do in a short story, but I think my fear is that I might figure out how to write a novel, but that I would forget how to write a short story. And that also I might not be as good at writing a novel, but that's, you know, the fear that you're not going to write a very good one is maybe not the best reason not to do it.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I love short stories.
Thank you.
And anyone who's not read any of Kelly Link's short fiction really should, because you're completely missing out. You don't write conventional is not the word, but your writing is unique. And you say that every writer's work is unique to them, but Kelly's writing is something very, very different from the general idea of the shape of a short story and what a short story is meant to do. I mean, her work is amazing. So if anyone hasn't read Kelly Link, we probably will do a book of yours on the podcast, I think.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing about novels is that, you know, because I work with Gavin at Small Beer, I get to edit novels, so I write often with Holly Black and with Cassandra Clare, so I get to see novels in the process of being written. And I love talking with people about how novels work. Sometimes that's a little bit of a push to write one, but, you know, I would be equally happy just sitting and looking at only short stories, talking about how short stories work and, you know, as the thing that I do for fun, just reading novels. And novels are fun. Short stories are work. You know, short stories feels like the thing that I'm supposed to do.
Yeah.
Have you thought of speaking to Harlan Ellison? Because he's made a career out of writing short stories.
He's made a career out of not writing short stories as much as writing short stories. And I've done the same thing. You know, I don't write that often.
You've got a lot of books, though.
Yes.
Don't know where that was going, but I just thought you could ask him and say, because I assume he would have got that question asked of him, when are you going to write a novel? He did write one novel, didn't he, with someone? It was on his own, or was someone spider or something or other?
He has a handful.
Yeah. I mean, they're slim novels. They're not the large doorstopper novels we've come to.
Jonathan, if you're in the audience, I'm going to ask you. If I was in the dining room, obviously I wouldn't have an opportunity to ask you. Yeah, I know the podcast can't hear him, but that makes it more powerful for me. So apparently, according to Jonathan, Harlan has written a few novels, and Kirsten's backed that up, and so has Kelly, and I'm wrong. So that was a stupid question to ask.
M.R. James never wrote a novel.
Yeah, but he lived hundreds and hundreds of years ago, and in those days...
they had to handcraft the novels.
Yeah, it's a lot harder. But just speaking for myself, I'd be equally happy also if you only ever wrote short stories for the rest of your writing life as well, as long as they continue to be marvelous and unique.
What if they're kind of crap every once in a while? Would that be okay?
If they're Kelly Link kind of crap, I can live with that.
All right.
I have a feeling that Kelly Link kind of crap is still yards above a whole bunch of other people's kind of crap. Or actually, a whole bunch of other people's really good stuff. So,
really nice.
I really like Kelly's work.
Okay, it's great.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
With short stories, and I guess we've in Australia, we've seen mostly, I guess, being pushed by the small press, a lot of novellas and short story collections being published in the last couple of years. And they seem to be, they are very well received. They seem to sell quite well, again, on a small press level of print run. I'm just wondering if either Kelly or Alison, what do you see with perhaps ebooks and that sort of capability? There's maybe more of a market for short fiction out there than there was maybe 10 years ago?
I guess I would say that there's not less of a market for short stories, so that's something.
Yeah. But you don't see a...
It's kind of I've been asked to write this short story as a pre-runner to the novel, so it's kind of been used as add-ons and value-added and ways of expanding out in a more I think more vigorously.
So
yes, I mean I think the market for short stuff is increasing as ways of like a marketing tool as well. Yeah.
Well, there's the Amazon singles and things like that, which a number of people are getting involved in. So, but you didn't ask me the question.
No, you can answer it.
That's the answer I would have given, that there's Amazon singles and things like that authors can use to advertise their longer works if they feel, or just write an Amazon single.
Amazon singles are kind of, they're a work in their own
right. And I think that there is potential for a short story to reach a much larger audience than pre-internet because, you know, whether or not a short story is published online at some point in its life, the writer can put it online, at which point it can be sort of passed around, reader to reader, in a way that when stories were being published only in print magazines, that was not necessarily the case.
Mm. Well, that's good. That's encouraging because... Mm.
Why, are you thinking of writing more short stories, Kirsten?
No, it's encouraging because I love reading. Like I think I do prefer, if you're going to pin me down to a particular form, I would say I have favourite works that are short fiction
than novels. There's an Australian group called La Short Story, and they're always looking for people to read more short fiction. And I know you've got a lot of time.
I have so much time.
A couple of them in the audience, I think you know. Yeah. I don't know if you know them, and you might want to have a chat to them.
Mm.
Yeah, okay. Mm.
All my time. That's actually so funny because I just had that thought aloud at home the other day that maybe next year I could ask to join Last Short Story. And
they seem excited.
My husband gave me the filthiest look you've ever seen. No, you have a novel to write. See, novels, they stop you doing fun things.
With short stories, I think a couple of years ago I realized, every once in a while you get some writers together and they talk about something like the Lucy Lane Clifford story, The New Mother. And at a certain point I realized, I can just go online and I can find the story in its entirety and sort of send it to whoever it was who hasn't read it. Mm. And Joe Hill has all of his stories up on Amazon as singles as well as a collection. So you can go and buy a really great story for 99 cents.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
So if you haven't read The New Mother, I recommend Googling it and reading it.
Oh, excellent. We'll put a link for that in the show notes. Okay. Well, should we move on to the books?
Oh, I can't wait. Yes. And the first one we're doing is The Crystal Singer,
which was recommended by Alison Goodman. The format for this one is a little different to what we've done previously. Normally, Ian and I would recommend the books, and if we had a guest on, they would recommend one as well. But as we thought, four books, probably a little too many to talk about in under 5 hours. Ian and I have recommended nothing, so we're placing this podcast entirely in the hands of our guests. We shall start with Alison's recommendation, The Crystal Singer. And I just want to ask Alison...
I think you should.
I just wanted to ask Alison just to say a few brief words about why she chose the book.
Yeah. I think I chose it because it was a nostalgic piece for me, the recent passing of Anne McCaffrey. And it was a book that was quite important to me in my teenage years as a young female reader and an Anne McCaffrey fan. And it was interesting to see, does it stand up to the test of time? In two ways, really, as a read, but also because I'm now a writer, and to see whether or not craft-wise it stood up. I read it many, many times when I was a teenager and had very, very fond memories of it. So it's been an enlightening experience.
I was going to ask you if the Suck Fairy had visited the book.
As I was saying to Jonathan, the Suck Fairy landed a few times. It's interesting because I was reading with memory of my enjoyment and with experience now. So it was a kind of a tense read for me. I wanted so much to be that teenage girl saying, yeah, I love this book. And the woman that I am now was saying expectable. She used the word expectable. What the hell's that? So there was that kind of tension. I still think that there's some very good things about it,
mm-hmm.
but we can discuss that as we go along. But I think that, the Suck Fairy did land.
Aww.
Well, I was just asking the audience, how many have read this 1982 classic by Anne McCaffrey? Wow, that's a good chunk of the people in the audience.
How many have read this 1982 classic by Anne McCaffrey post, say, 2000?
And that's three people. Paul. Okay.
Interesting.
Yeah, I reread. Okay. How many people are going to be offended if I say rude things about it in the next 25 minutes? Okay, one person. Well, we at least reduced from about 40 to 4 to 1, so...
Okay. Well, I will go on. I'll say up front that I had never read any Anne McCaffrey before this book. I'm not inclined to read any now either, having read this book, unless there's another one of hers that is...
Well, there's two more in the series.
I'm not reading
there's
any
Killer
more
There's Killer Chandra
of this
and The Crystal Lion, I think.
No.
How's that from memory?
I have been recommended.
Those are the two books, aren't they? Yeah. I'm not looking at anything. That just came right out of the brain.
You secretly love them, don't you? You secretly love them.
Very secretly. Yes.
Yeah, I can't say that I really liked this book at all.
Can I just start on one thing,
yes,
please? Jim Hines has done a blog post on female covers and poses on, and he's tried to pose on a lot of contemporary female covers. Has anyone seen the cover to The Crystal Singer and the woman? She's got her up back, arched back in an impossible position with the crystal aloft in her hands, and I'd love him. I'd do a call out to Jim Hines to try and do the cover for The Crystal Singer because I think he... it's a podcast, Tansy. Tansy would like me to do it right now, and that would, A, hurt me, and B, it's a visual thing.
I'm happy to take a photo.
All right, it's something like this.
Here's the crystal.
Yeah, no, I've first got to check reference here, just because I did bring it up on my technology. So, yeah, all right. She's also touching her ass, so I've got to take that into account. Oh, no, she's not. She's holding some sort of... that's the blade thing.
Oh, wow, I have a completely different cover.
I've got a completely different colour too.
So it's sort of like... Take a photo now!
If people in the audience have taken a photo of Ian Mon's magnificent pose, can you please email it to us at writeandcritic@gmail.com, and I'll make sure that goes in the show notes too for the people listening at home.
So are we all aware of the cover? Because it's very hard for me to show, but I've just done it. But can we all see that on my iPad?
I'm going to have to dig up that cover.
It may not be the original cover, but it's the one I got from the secondhand bookstore. And in fact, when I went on Advanced Book Exchange, because I want it for some reason, it's not online, so I bought it. And that's all right, Alison, I didn't mind spending the money. that was about the only cover I could find on ABE. So I think it's now the cover. Oh, so this is Michael Whelan, is it? Thanks, Michael. All right, so that really hurt. No, that's done me in. Can you do this on one on your own? Because I'm rooted.
No, you can just sit there in pain now.
Okay, that's great. Thanks. All right. Well, you know, you can get all three books in one book, and that cover's a lot more simpler. She's just holding. It's actually fatty. It's a lot more dainty. She's like looking at the just like this. It's very very dainty. That's another visual image.
That's another visual image.
Won't work. Anyway, so yes, say something.
So covers
about the book.
Covers aside. I don't know. I really liked the underlying concept of the book, which was the idea that there is this planet that has crystals that you mine, and the way you mine them is by seeking out their pitch, and it's these crystals that end up sort of powering this intergalactic civilization through transport and communication and a whole bunch of things. So they're really, really valuable, and I liked all of that. The Killer Chandra, who's the main character, shat me to tears. She's just so, everything good happens to her. She's the best at everything. If she wants something, it happens. You know, everyone's friends with her except this one girl who dies.
That's really annoying because the most interesting character, who you only get snippets of her, gets the terrible illness that they all get when they do their transformation as part of adapting to the planet. Was it Belly Bran? Is that the
Belly Bran's a
Belly Bran. Yeah. I actually love that name. But as part of the adaptation, and she's the only one to die. The one who's, you know.
Because they needed to show someone dying.
Yes, yes, the one who's actually providing a critique, which I thought was interesting that McCaffrey was providing some sort of critique of the society and of the way these people work and how they're all so cliquey and closeted and we're so special. And then she carks it halfway through.
Well, that's
not
even
halfway.
I don't think, like, in view of what happens to that character and so early as well in the book. And she's never spoken of again. I don't think she is there to provide a critique. I think she's there to be a whingy whiny bitch who gets killed. Seriously, she's there
what,
to have
your thoughts, Alison and Kelly? Whingy whiny bitch, or are we?
That is how everyone perceives her. Like all of the other characters, including Killassandra.
What is wrong with being a bitch?
Nothing.
Oh, no, there's nothing wrong.
I think that what I was attracted to with Killassandra was that she started off as an unsympathetic character. That was probably one of the first times I came across an unsympathetic character in a novel who was the main protagonist. So I think that was one of the things that interested me in Killassandra. She's not always a sympathetic character. She makes decisions that are selfish and based on what I found was a very strong line of ambition, which again was unusual in a female character, and that is unremitting. She is always ambitious. I did like that about her. She is self-consciously ambitious, and only I think McCaffrey does pull her back and literally say that she pulls back from being that ambition I think only once during the whole book. So in terms of a protagonist, I found her quite interesting. Yes, the good things do happen to her, and I agree with that, quite regularly. But again, it is a fantasy, and it's a fantasy for young women. I think it's a power fantasy for young women.
Yeah.
And so in terms of it doing its job in that way, it really spoke to me as a young woman saying, I can be a bitch and I can get what I want.
Yeah, and no, I mean, maybe if I'd read this when I was in my teens, I would have a different reaction to the book. I think it was it's more that everything comes easy. There's no tension in the book. By the time you get about, two-thirds of the way through and there's this other thing that she's got to do that's really hard, you're reading the book going, she's going to do it. And she does.
Yeah. Interesting.
Tension there.
I was really interested because I thought that the tension in the book would be, does she become a crystal singer? That is not the tension in the book.
No.
And I realised that on this kind of look at it again, looking at it craft-wise, because McCaffrey over and over again gives us a jump into the future, which says she will become a crystal singer. This is not what the story is about.
Yeah.
So that made me think, what is the story about? If it's not about will she become a crystal singer, what is it about? I'm still thinking about that.
I was going to ask if you knew what that was about.
I'm still thinking, if that's not what the tension in the story is about, what is it about? And I think it is about it's about talent and ambition.
Well, it's three short stories that were written for Continuum, funnily enough, Continuum Anthology, back in 74 and 75. Again, I did that off the top of my head. Well done, Ian. Pat myself on the back. Now, I don't know how short the short stories were. I've never read them. Did you ever go back to read the original, Kelly? Short stories that Crystal Singer's based on?
No.
I mean, I think I've probably read the first story in an anthology at some point.
Okay. So, I mean, you can sort of tell what they are. I assume her first transformation, or the transformation to a crystal thing, is probably the first story. The cutting of the black crystal is probably the second, and then going off to fit the crystal is probably the third, but that's just complete guessing. But she does talk about, I mean, there's a very small little introduction where she says, yes, it is these three short stories, and it's a fix-up novel for the most part. But and that's probably why maybe there isn't a clear through line as to what's the point of this, because it's... Mm. It is three pieces that have been put together, and therefore...
Sorry, I'll just correct you there, Ian, because it is four stories.
They're four stories.
Yep.
So I was wrong. Thanks. Right. that's what you're here for, Kirsten.
But and the research I did says that they were... I mean, I haven't... weren't able to track down the original stories to read them, but it did say she had greatly expanded them and even changed things in them, so it's not just that she took four stories and put them together and wrote a bridge. Apparently she did kind of expand and tweak a few things.
Because the structure really is odd. She spends 80% of the book on the planet and then it goes off and does a mission and then comes back to have sex with the bloke who's running the place, and that's the end. Yeah. I've just spoiled the entire novel, but that's really it.
Let's provide a little bit of context here.
Thank you.
One, you know, she's writing these books in a time period where, you know, there have not been a lot of stories with very active female protagonists. Mm. You know, that was one of the things that she set out to do when she started writing was she was writing partly in response to science fiction stories in which, you know, guys fought the aliens and the women were sort of screaming in the corner, she says. Mm. And the other thing is that she had been a singer herself and had had to give up that career because of a fault in her voice. And so I think this was probably a very personal book for her. And here's the thing about Anne McCaffrey is when I was a kid, you know, I actually loved the Pern books. I absolutely
so
loved
do I.
those. And even the Pern books, especially the is it Lyssa who's the heroine of the older?
Yeah.
I mean, she's not always a very sympathetic character, and I think that it is important in fiction to, you know, have characters to whom good things happen, who are not necessarily likable people. And it was actually fascinating to read those books. And it was much easier in some ways to identify with somebody who is not necessarily good all the time, but who wants something and who achieves it. And so I think if you think of, you know, some of her work at least as being, you know, the story in some way is just setting out to write a book in which a woman does things that traditionally books men do.
Changes
the world in which she actually gets to be the hero of her own story.
Mm. Yeah, I think all that I'm completely on board with. And as I said, if I'd read it when I was a teenager, I think I would have really, really loved that. It's just the lack of tension in the book and the lack of. I mean, and yeah, you just know. I mean, I actually thought as I was reading it, I was hoping what McCaffrey was doing was setting up Killer Chandra to have this really easy ride of it all the way through, and then at that last mission, something is going to go wrong, and she's going to have to reach a bit further inside herself and do something to actually address a situation which isn't going her way. And I was just really bitterly disappointed when that wasn't the case and her mission goes well and she's the best crystal singer ever again. Mm-hmm. I would react exactly the same way if this was a male protagonist with exactly the same plot line and all the good things happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is a shame. I kind of wanted a bit more meat in this book, a bit more to hang on to. Mm.
But it's written in a, I think it's fairly early in McCaffrey's career, and so she hasn't quite developed the depth that she has in the Pern novels. So there's a lot of what I call skim writing.
Oh, so Pern comes later than this?
Because
this
is some of them. I think it's sort of in the middle. It's before maybe the Harper Hall book. She started before this.
Yeah.
Okay, because the original story is in the mid-70s, but the actual book itself is 82.
Not too sure about the dates there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We've been told by our wonderful audience, 67. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, wonderful audience.
And, so I felt that there was a lot of skim writing. So it was like very quick narrative summary that doesn't engage the reader as much as one would hope. Mm. I mean, she really comes to life when she's speaking about the singing, which, of course, is quite personal to her, as Kelly spoke about. So that's where she dwells, and that's where we get the richness. But the characterization does fail a bit.
Well, that's what the point I was going to raise. My issue wasn't that she was unsympathetic, but how workmanlike the writing was. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know if that's because of contextually, that's the era, and a lot of SF authors of that time are writing a very basic. It's not that it's basic, because actually I found it a slog at times. I didn't find it to be transparent and zip through writing. I found it to be actually quite sloggy. Yes, when she's cutting the black, as I say it, that's beautiful. That's when you're right. The story just comes absolutely alive at that point. But that's about it. I suppose the bit when she's fitting the crystals and they're all connecting together for that first time, and she's never experienced that before, and so that's towards the end. That's also quite a beautiful bit of writing there. But everything in between, there were times, if I didn't have to do it for the podcast, I would have probably stopped. I just found it to be a slog from sentence to sentence, forgetting the stuff, the plot going on at the same time. I don't know. Yeah. You said you read it from a craft perspective, Alison, so...
Yeah, look, I did. I kept on putting it down. When I was a teenager, I did not put it down, but I kept on putting it down because the writing wasn't flowing through it for me as much as some of her other work. The Pern stuff flows a lot better for me. There's a lot more characterization, deeper characterization. So yeah, I did have that same feeling where the writing itself was becoming a barrier to the story. Not all the time. I mean, as you say, there's patches where it's beautiful, and I think that is definitely based around the intrigue of the crystal cutting, and those sections where she talks about voice and sound and singing.
It looks like there are some members of our audience that are leaving so offended by our critique. So, see you, Tansy, Jonathan. Bye bye. Well, you don't all have to go. That was a joke. I didn't think you were all. Oh, God.
You sent them. They're all gone. You know, when I was a kid, you know, I don't think it mattered to me very much what the writing was like. Mm. You know, it really is just story, ideas. Is there something about the character that tells you something necessary about yourself or about other people?
Yeah.
And as an adult, you know, still the things that I love about McCaffrey, she world building.
Yeah.
And names. I think Kalashandarvi is a beautiful name.
Yeah.
Menelie is a great name. When I was a kid, I used to fantasize about, you know, creating characters who had names like that.
Yeah, no, I like, I know what you're saying about when you're younger, there's things you just completely gloss over. There was an author who I adored when I was probably 8 to 10, 11-ish. Her name was Ruth Chu, and she wrote these strange little books, and they always featured a brother and a sister, and the sister was always older than the brother. So she had the sort of the leadership role out of the two of them. And they would just have these little magic things. It was set just very much real contemporary world. And I don't know whether she was an American or Canadian, because when you're 8, America and Canada are the same thing in Australia. So it was this North American setting in a city. And these two brother and sisters, who were different in every book, they weren't the same brother and sister, they would find some little magic artifact which did something. And I remember I read these books multiple times. I absolutely love them. And I tried to read one again just a couple years ago, and the writing was so woeful. Oh. It was kind of twee and none of that I got at all when I was 8 or 9, and now I couldn't even finish the book.
Does this teach us?
Well, I think that's
it teaches we're quite uncritical as readers when we're young from points of view of technique. We like stories and we like characters, and we are quite uncritical about a whole bunch of things. We're uncritical about political stuff. We're uncritical about representations of gender and race and social class. We're uncritical about all of that. We take the stories and we read them, and whether we like them or we don't, and we don't really think about why we like them.
I think it's also like a truism that, you know, when you start studying the craft of writing, you start destroying your ability to read. I mean, you know, you actually have become. Sometimes you've got to get out of your own way when you're reading something, because always the writer and the craft person is clicking in and saying, "Well, why are they doing this? What is this happening? Do I, you know, is that working?" And I did find that my writerly self was clicking in a bit too much. occasionally I was able to just relax back into it and say, yeah, look, this is the world building is fabulous in the Crystal Singer. Mm. I get every time I think about the Bally Brand economy and political setup and that, it's just like blows me away. It's brilliant. And just the way that it's all spread out into that universe. And, you know, the idea of Killashandra herself excites me. So, you know, if I can put my writerly self away.
Which is hard to do. Kelly, do you find it hard to push your writer self away when you're just wanting to engage your reader self?
Sometimes, you know. I think there are books that I won't go back to unless there's a very good reason. Mm-hmm. I loved the Xanth novels when I was a kid.
Piers Anthony Xanth.
Yeah. And I could not understand why. You know, I kept on telling my dad, you really have to read these. They're so good. And I think he finally read one, and I could tell that he didn't like it. And I thought, what is wrong with him? you know, there. And so I don't know that I would go back to those because I really loved them. You know, there's something about the puns that I found enormously satisfying. But, you know, I go back every couple of years and I reread Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. And sometimes I find the prose bumpy and uneven. Mm-hmm. And I have a hard time seeing how it works. And then the next year I go back and reread it and I actually think the writing is gorgeous.
Mm. It's interesting, isn't it? It's a different... I have only recently come back to the idea of rereading. I was a voracious rereader as a child because I didn't have that many books. But it's only been really actually this podcast has reintroduced me to the idea of rereading because occasionally Ian will recommend a book that I've read but a few years ago, so I need to read it again to refresh myself. And there's quite... for a start, usually, unless the suck fairy has visited, usually... when you reread a book that you liked, you're guaranteed that you're going to have a good reading experience, which you don't get with a book you haven't read. You might hate it and then you feels like, ah, I could have been reading something else. But you get – it's a different – it's the same but a very different book. And it's there's quite a pleasure I've found now in rereading. And I think I'm going to pull out a few favourite books and start rereading them every couple of years.
May I ask a question?
Sure.
What's with the coitus in the novel? No, I'll tell you why I asked it. That's not as silly as it sounds. It is a little bit. But it's just that she has a lot of sex, which is fine. I don't have a problem with that. But it's just odd how McCaffrey does it in that the camera, and I'm obviously very discreet, but McCaffrey's quite happy for there to be a lot of sex, but without going into any great detail. And it just felt odd at times. Maybe I'm just used to books written today where there'd be a lot more, it'd be a lot more overt. Mm. There's obviously lots of loving going on, but not much describing of the loving.
I think it's the time and the market, actually, that would address that. Time and market, I think. And McCaffrey, all through her novels, doesn't go deeply into the sexual act, so just, you know, innuendo aside. So she doesn't describe it often.
This is the thing that happens when you hit a certain age and you have loved Anne McCaffrey novels is... Which is the, you know, in the Pern novels, the problem of how did the mechanics of this work? Is there a large circle of people watching while the, you know, the two dragon riders are having sex? Because that makes me deeply uncomfortable. In fact, that has been the thing that prevents me from going back and rereading those books, is I think I would be enormously distracted by trying to figure out. And it's not, it's actually... I would be perfectly happy if it was a weird sort of sexual ritual and it was described. It's just that, again, I'm imagining my teenage self reading the book and sort of taking all of this and not thinking about it. And
as I recall, the dragon riders do get to go up to the bedroom for some privacy.
Do they? Good. And then there's the problem of the tent peg theory of homosexuality, which...
Yes, which came out a few times after a death, a few people posted about that, which I wasn't going to mention, I want to say, because Kirsten knows that I'm aware of the tent peg.
He's had a mini rant about that before, and I said to him, we're not talking about tent pegs on this podcast.
Do you know about the tent peg theory, Alison?
No, I do not.
Okay. Kelly, please, can you brought it up, I'll not
saying
it.
I will, this is, again, something that happens when you are a fan of Anne McCaffrey and you attend science fiction conventions is at some point someone will pull you aside and explain to you Anne McCaffrey's theory of homosexuality, which is that it can be caused by accidentally, the way it was described to me was she felt that sometimes a man could accidentally fall on a tent peg. It would, you know, it would go up his butt, and after that, he would be gay because of the sort of release of hormones or something. That,
yeah.
And actually, when I looked it up online, it was actually, she said that she had once known a young man who had been raped by tent peg, and after that, he became gay.
Which is even more problematic, really, when you think about it, to say that if a man is raped, he will be... he'll become gay.
I have nothing to say to that. There's nothing I can say to that that would... No.
But anyway, what I might do is, at this point, is are there any questions from the audience about anything we've been talking about the Anne McCaffrey book or Anne McCaffrey herself? Anything? Nope.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, one, I'll just... You ask a question, I'll repeat it. Okay, so the question was, the Pern novel, The White Dragon, was the only one of Anne McCaffrey's Pern novels to win a Hugo, and the audience member just wanted to know what the panel thought of that particular book.
That's actually my favourite Anne McCaffrey book. I think that it holds together very well as a novel. I have reread that a couple of times, and it holds, you know, no suck fairy for me.
Great. Kelly?
Yeah, I have not read it in a while. I loved it uncritically, and I mean that in both senses. I absolutely loved it. I don't know if it was good or not. But I can remember going to the bookstore as a teenager and seeing the cover and thinking that the cover was the most beautiful thing I had seen. And, you know, I think there's that desire you have when you're a teenager to have a horse, a sword, and a dragon.
But in terms of structure, it's a very elegantly structured book. And it's a coming of age, coming to realization of identity story. And it's very nicely structured and beautifully done.
Excellent. Any other questions from the audience? No? Okay. We might move on to the next book then, as we've just
Can I just say one thing?
Oh, okay. Sure.
When it's a very straight novel, the McCaffrey, but then suddenly the word shit is used about halfway, two-thirds of the way through, I laughed. I just did. Because you were saying before,
thank you
were saying at lunch yesterday that you thought it was a young adult novel, which it still could be with the word shit in
it. Well, no, I when I was researching about it and the history and the publication context, it was intimated that this was written as a young adult novel.
Okay.
But I've since been told that that's not the case. So my Wikipedia failed me. Not just Wikipedia, but that was a primary culprit.
I'm easily amused by the use of swear words in books, so that's all I wanted to say. No, we can move on to...
okay.
Yes.
Okay, well, all right, we'll
move
on.
Thank you, though, Alison, because although I probably won't... Actually, I might read the Ship Who Sang. That's something we haven't spoken about those, but... Yeah.
That's the one that's been recommended
story,
to me.
So you can read the short story and then the novel.
So I don't think I've killed McCaffrey off completely. Yeah.
Again, great ideas, great world building.
Yeah, the Ship Who Sang is the one that's been recommended by me when I was saying to people, oh, I just read this Anne McCaffrey book and I don't think I'll ever read anything by her again. And that was the one that people said, well, read that. Mm. And if you don't like that, then you don't have to read anything by Anne McCaffrey. So I think I'll probably check that one out.
And even if you don't, you know, enjoy her books or if they are hard to read as an adult, they are enormously influential.
Oh, yeah, no, definitely.
Everybody who's
definitely.
Yeah, influenced me.
Yeah, me too.
Okay, so we're going to move on to the book that Kelly recommended for us, which is The Scorpio Races by Maggie Stavarta. I hope I pronounced that correctly. Do you know if that's a correct pronunciation?
I have no idea. Let's
say Stavarta.
Say it differently every time.
Sorry, Maggie, if we've got that wrong. And that was only published mid to late last year, I think, so it's fairly new. And why did you choose this book, Kelly?
Because I had just read it and I had loved it. And I think the reason that I loved it, it's a fantasy novel, but it is also a horse book.
Mm.
So it combines two of my great loves as a young adult reader, which are horses and fantasy.
Yeah, I really, really liked it. I think if I had read it when I was the age that it's intended to be written for, which it is a young adult book, I think it would have been my most favourite book ever, 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 ever in the world. Mm. It's like a book that was written for Kirsten's.
What did you say? It's a book with horses that eat other horses.
Well, it's a book about horses and a girl who triumphs and the horses eat the other horses. It's like it's got all of them because usually you don't get both. You get the nice horsey book,
yeah,
or you get the nasty horrific book with things eating each other, and this somehow magically brings them together and does it so well. I really like this book.
Well, I liked it too, but probably not as much as you. But I was going to see if any... Because this is quite a new book and we are going to spoil it. So we can have an empty room by the end of this question. Has anyone read it? No one.
Okay.
So,
we probably won't advance, spoil every single element.
I don't know what you thought, Alison, but I loved... Well, I didn't like it as much as you, but I liked it. You loved it.
I know you did.
Obviously, Kelly, you enjoyed it greatly.
Yes.
So if it's something that... Well, yeah, we'll try not to spoil it, but I think you just did by saying Girl Who Triumphed.
It's possibly
kind of that kind of a book, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, all right, fine. Yes, my only... obviously, I don't have the horse fetish thing that...
such a fetish.
It's what I'm calling it. as you guys do. But I struggled... The only thing I struggled with was the relationship between Sean and Puck, the two main characters of the book, it would have worked so much better for me if it hadn't have been a romance, because I think the book didn't need that romantic link. It actually felt there was a tension of the book struggling against the romance between the two, which may be common in young adult novels anyway, where they sort of don't like each other and learn to fall in love with each other or whatever. But it seemed to have been struggling on that level about that sort of relationship, and then yes, eventually they do, you know, fall in love. And I just didn't buy that part. The rest I bought completely. But
that's really interesting. I'll come back to that. But I want to know what Alison... What did you think of the book, Alison?
I really enjoyed this book. I did... My writer, Lee Person, popped up a couple of times with just some plot points.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah? Like what? No, I'm interested. No, because... Yeah.
This is a beautifully written book. It is, the horse stuff is magnificent, and you know, riding horses is difficult enough, but riding them so well is magnificent. It's lyrical. I didn't have any problem with the romance aspect of it.
Yeah.
I love the horror. I read this book with a genuine feeling of dread throughout it all. That was just delicious. I was delicious with dread.
That should be a quote on the book. Delicious with dread.
And I felt that the way she'd built up this world, the superstitions around the horses and the reality of the how do we pronounce them? The Cap.
I don't know.
Kapel Ishka, I think it is. The Kapel Ishka, which are the water horses that come from the ocean. They were all beautifully done. The actual arc of each character was beautiful, but the way that she'd built up the horror of being in the water in November when the Kapel Ishka were at their most active, I felt that when Sean, the character, the main lead, takes Fundamental out to swim, I felt he would not have done that. And it's so much is built on that I felt it weakened it for me slightly. So that was me.
Fundamental is a horse, by the way.
Is a horse. I can see the mechanics of it, and I can see that it's required and it's there and that kind of stuff. And I could see that the ass covering that she was doing to shore that up. And I think for most readers that would not be a problem at all. But that was just me being a super kind of my Riley went. And it was kind of like dee, 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 dee. So I didn't feel as convinced by that moment as I should have been, but it still didn't wreck the book for me because it's such a beautifully done book.
So when they go in the water, you know what's going to happen as a writer.
Well, I felt that I didn't believe that Sean would have taken that horse into that cove at that time.
Yeah. But he sort of didn't the wasn't it said that they had to train the horses in the water, and that was the safest. It was considered that was the safest part of
It was talked about the cushioning effect of water on the horses' training, bones and that kind of stuff. Still not strong enough for me, especially not with the kind of dread that had been built up around.
But fundamental is just an ordinary horse.
Yeah.
That's the other thing.
But he was a very valuable horse. You don't want
very valuable. Yeah. That's another thing. It was a very valuable horse. So for me, that was and because Sean is one of it's the mysterious male character. So he's there's always something withheld in that character. And he has a kind of sweeping ability with these horses. So, and he's always, he looks after the horses, and for us, he's the one who cares for the horses throughout the book. So he's our guy, our go-to guy for the horses. So I didn't think he'd put them at the risk.
Yeah, no, I can see that. Yeah, definitely.
So no one agrees with me on the love affair?
Nah.
No, I...
Is this because I'm a guy or am I missing something?
I loved so many things.
Nah. Is it because you're loveless?
Oh, what? What? That's terrible.
I loved a lot of things about this book. But one of the things I loved was the actual dealing of the burgeoning romantic subplot, because I love that neither Puck, Kate, or Sean lets their, and they don't start off hating each other.
They don't.
It's not this, oh, I hate you, actually that means I love you, that's a trope I really, really dislike, because most of the time when you hate someone, you just hate them. You're not suppressing anything. You hate them. They're an awful person, you think, and you hate them. So it's a very misused trope, I think,
I've mischaracterised it.
So they don't. They start off just people who kind of know each other from sight on the island, because the book is set on a small island, so it's a small community and a very closed in community, and because they're working in the same field, as it were, they get thrown into close proximity. There's a little bit of friction because Kate is using her. Kate enters the Scorpio races, which is the races usually run by the water horses, and people get killed and horses attack each other, and it's a very violent race. And the female protagonist, there's two, it's written in two first-person narratives that are interchanged. And Puck is, she enters the race for various reasons, but she rides her own horse, which is a horse. It's not a water horse. It's not part water horse. It's her own horse. Just a horse as well. It's like it's almost a pony, but people keep calling it a pony, and she keeps saying, no, 15 hands.
Not just a normal horse, but a horse whose name is Dove.
Yes. So she's sort of training, but not with the water horses because they might eat her pony. So they're sort of in close proximity, and they're And as two people are, if they're working in close proximity on the same sort of project, they start to find out things about each other and decide that each other are a bit interesting. But it never takes over what they're doing. And it's only at the end of the book, it's only after they've seen to their job, as it were, the race has been run, they've done all that, that's sorted, that then there's this sort of agreement between the two of them that actually we find each other kind of interesting, we should explore this, but we'll explore it like after the book finishes, after we've done all our stuff. I loved that.
I like that too. I think what I like about it is that it feels very natural. They are two people. They have a common interest, as you said. They are both, and I think the writer does a very good job of making you feel that they are both kind of extraordinary people. They're both driven, they are both heroic, and I think it feels very natural that they would at least like each other.
Yeah, and they start as friends.
It's very subtle.
They become friends before they maybe more from Sean's
it's
point of view.
It's possibly I don't like Sean.
It's
that's
possibly
what it comes down to, that I possibly don't like Sean. He just felt a bit too detached at times from the narrative. And I know that's his character and all that, but I think that's maybe what it comes down to.
Because
I loved Puck. I thought she was great.
Yeah.
Puck is great. I think what I while we're talking about this, what I'd like to bring up is that that she does an extraordinary job of making both points of view very appealing. And so I never felt moving from point to viewed a point of view, oh, I wish I was staying with Puck, or I wish I was staying with Sean. I actually didn't even notice that I was moving points of view. The story really flows very effortlessly through those changes. And I think if you're a writer, you know that that's really hard to pull off.
Yeah.
I did have a little bit of a problem at the beginning because I felt the voices were very similar at the beginning. They did come apart from each other later on in a much more way as you got to. So it could be a device, and I'm quite willing to have that advice. It in no way detracted from my reading of it, but they were quite similar at the beginning. And then they began to get their individualities as they went along. I did have a problem with trying to ascertain what age Puck was. I'm sure it's probably stated somewhere, but the voice sounded very young at the beginning. Yes. And again, it could be that it's the coming of age, the voice ages as it went along. But
I think what I decided, because I also had that trouble, I decided that this book is set, it's a period book. It's set, it's not set, no, it's,
it's set 1915, but you don't know that till the very close to the end. At least I didn't know that, unless
you know
it's in the blur.
You know that at a certain point, but I think what I decided was that she feels younger than somebody her age would feel. Both younger and older, she has more responsibilities, but she is also innocent, not in the way we think of it now, but she just is not very experienced.
I just thought she was 16. I just went with that.
I thought she was like 13 at the beginning.
Oh, okay.
And I thought, whoa, Sean. whoa, steady on there, boy. And then, of course, as I got over that initial surprise, I readjusted the aging of her. And did that retro reading and saying, okay, she's actually maturing in front of me.
Yeah. I think she's about 15-ish, 15, 16. That's the age I sort of pegged her at.
Do you know who I loved in this book? Finn.
The younger brother.
And I get the feeling, and I may be completely wrong, but that he's possibly autistic or has an obsessive compulsive disorder or some sort of issue.
Yeah, I thought I
said think... Stefata handles that beautifully without, you know, someone going, yes, there's something, there's a bit of that, there's something wrong with Finn, but it's, and there's a bit of that thinking on Puck's, but more just we can't tell him this information because we know he won't react well to it. It's not, you know, shoved down your throat. I think that handling is, and Finn made me cry more than anything else. That I didn't actually cry that much. I seem to cry at the end of every novel these days, but Finn really got to me as a character, and I just think it was the way that she dealt with, even though he's not a viewpoint character, how she dealt with him, how Stavada deals with the character. I don't know what others thought.
I really liked at the end, actually, because they do handle Finn kind of kid glovish, and then at the end he gets really mad, and it's like, why aren't you telling me things? Why are you keeping... Like, it's really good, because as the reader, you're going along agreeing with the way they're shielding him and not telling him some bad things which are going to happen because they think he'll freak out. And then when he says that, you realise, that was a really shitty way to be treating that character. He should have been informed of these changes that were happening in his life, that he wasn't. And it's really, really good that comes up at the end.
Mm. I may have a different... strange reading of this ending. It's very recent for me, so I haven't really thought it through as fully as I'd like to. But symbolically, and sorry, spoilers, guys, symbolically it felt like to me that what Stefano was writing was love will bring you many things, but to a certain extent it will hobble you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see that.
Because of the way it hobbles Sean and he has to give up.
And Core.
Yeah, and Core, yes. Core. Yes. Yeah.
So that was symbolically for me. I thought, that's an interesting ending for this novel. So it's a very much a bittersweet ending, I felt.
Yeah.
And it's also, I love the fact, I think that one of the ways in which, if it's a love story, it's a very subtle love story. I don't think it is a love story. I think it's a story in which two of the characters recognize that they have a lot in common and that they like each other. Story. The story ends with separately. They are not together at the end.
Yeah.
She is negotiating with Malvern and he is with Cor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that I will not spoil this, but that last couple of paragraphs. I think I got a bit teary.
See, I
no, I did.
I did.
It's like it's just so beautifully. She has a very deft hand at making you expect certain turns of plot, without you actually consciously going, oh, I know what's going to happen now. But when it doesn't do that and you're really surprised, you realize that, wow, that I had been expecting this to happen. And
I had
now,
prepared myself for this.
Yeah.
Absolute master of that.
She's very good.
What's also brilliant about the book is that it's all building up to a race that you know is going to happen. And that race does happen at the very end, and you could argue, well, God, this is going to be padding for 300 pages because really the climax is the race. And the race doesn't take up that many pages in and of itself either. So you sort of – but that doesn't hurt the book, and there's none of this sort of, oh, get to the race already, get to the race, because there's so much going on, other things happening that the race in a sense gets sidelined and is a consequence of everything else. And I thought that was actually very smart because if it all, even though it all does focus on the race and the outcomes of the race, it's in a sense not the focus, oddly, not the focus of the novel. Even though it's the title of the novel.
The race is the thing that will happen at the end, but it's not.
It's going to be the climax always.
Yeah. And you know what was remarkable? Like, in the beginning when, like, as I'm starting to read the book and reading into it, I'm totally on Puck's side and I want her to win the race and she has to win the race. By the time the race actually occurs, the book has done so well with building Sean as a character and presenting what is really on the line for him. That I, like the race, I really didn't know who I wanted to win the race.
Yeah. I mean, when I got to that point where Stayforder separates those two characters to be absolutely in opposition at that for the race, I went, oh shit, to myself, because I thought, who am I going to want to win? Yeah. You know, it's like they both need it.
Yeah,
so much.
Really, really, really.
Yeah, she does a great job of raising the stakes for both of the characters, which really raises the stakes for the reader because you feel that that whatever happens, you're going to lose. Yeah. Somebody that you care about is going to lose.
And I think because of that, when she does, and again, I'll be careful how I phrase this because I really don't want to spoil it, but she does that little, because the race happens and someone wins, and that means someone loses, and she does this little thing where this other
thing happens.
That's real cool.
And it could have that could have just been so, oh God, that's convenient kind of thing. But I think because she had the reader invested so much in both characters and so disappointed, like equally happy for the character who wins the race and so bitterly disappointed for the character that doesn't, that when she does this little tiny twist...
Are we talking about Mutt?
No, the like after the race. She does this little twist, which means that actually it might not be so bad for the character who loses anyway. And that could have just been a bit twee and a bit... But it was like, oh, yay. Like, I was so happy when that happened.
Yeah, I think that I'd also like to say that for the writers in the audience, have a look at Stayforder's sequencing. That is, the way that she strings together a number of scenes to build up to a mini-climax. She does it over and over again, and it's just beautiful.
Yep.
It's just like, scene, mini-climax. Scene, mini-climax. It's just beautifully done.
Yeah, no, she's really amazing. And
You know, I was just going to say. Oh, no, I was going to slowly. No, no, continue, because I was going to go off topic. So
I just wanted to read a couple of sentences from...
Oh, okay. Well, if you're going to do that, can I say my bit?
Yeah, say your bit.
Yeah. So Mulvan, he's probably not the... He's a baddie in and of itself, and actually that was well done. I love the fact that he puts... was it butter and salt in his coffee?
tea.
Yeah. I actually thought for a moment that we're in some sort of weird alternate universe where people drink tea like that. Mm. But then, of course, Stafada makes a point that, yes, that is a bit, through Puck, that's not normal. But it's just that lovely, because Mulvan could easily have just been the arch villain of the piece. And that moment, not only... It doesn't humanise him at all. What it does is it does really set that idea of class about the novel, that there is that class tension running through the book, which does.
Yeah.
But does it in such a smart, clever way that, that's just part of that. I don't know the writerly craft stuff that well, but to me that just came out as something going, that's really smart. You don't need exposition there. It's just a little thing that happens that gives you that sense of the class battle going on here, which goes on throughout the novel.
I was thinking about this earlier, that I think all horse books are in some way about class.
Mm-hmm.
Brett Farrar, the books that I think of as Peyton, but I can't remember.
Is Black Beauty a bit?
With Yes, Flambard's...
Black Beauty's,
I guess,
definitely.
The writer is Peyton, right?
Black Beauty's about class?
Black definitely, Beauty, absolutely. Yeah.
That, I mean, in some way, horses are a stand-in for how we think about class.
Mm.
And I think just going back to the that salt and butter in the...
Do you do that, Alison?
No, I don't.
Did you think about doing it? Come on, you did,
no,
didn't
no,
you?
No, it appalled me, but... but I also felt that it was a way of Stavoda made him unpredictable and threatening.
Ah, yes, yes.
He, yeah, this kind of strange quirk, and it was so strange.
Which is very important at the end, because you don't know which way he'll go.
Yeah.
And also tells you that he doesn't care what people think of him.
Yeah.
And it was frothy.
Powerful.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Froth is up.
I was tempted to.
Did you?
I haven't tried it, but I was tempted to just make a cup of tea, like, so just to see what it would take. I think
we'll
it would
ask
be
our
vile.
Live audience and our audio audience is if anyone does it, can they tell us
know
what
how
happens?
Disgusting does it, it is.
I assume Maggie Stafada did go in the kitchen.
It would definitely froth up. The butter definitely would
yeah?
form a. Absolutely. If you're using. Yeah, no.
Well,
it would.
I know that Nepalese tea.
It definitely would.
Has butter in it. Yeah. So, but but there was also something weirdly, and maybe this is my own sickness coming through, but there was something weirdly sexual about it.
The butter and the salt.
Okay, yeah, that's I didn't read that.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe that's just me.
So would you like to read a bit from the book?
Yeah, I just wanted to read because I think one of the things this book, the author did so well is she's able to give you these little character beats without telling you explicitly that this is what the character's like. It'll just be something that the character thinks, and this was something Puck thinks, and it's very early on in the book. It's only in the first half dozen pages, and she's talking about her horse, Dove, and she says, "She is my mare and my best friend, and I keep waiting for something bad to happen to her because I love her too much." And that just, I mean, this is our first introduction to Puck, and that sort of line, it just sums up her character so well without going into backstory about, you know, something she lost because she liked too much or a little psychological character sketch. She just does these things with just a line here or there which kind of makes you sit back and go, oh, right, I completely get that character now. And she's masterful at it.
There's a scene later on when they're outside and one of the water horses, they realize that one of the water horses has come across the island and is that they are in great danger.
Oh,
and
that
scene was terrifying.
Yeah, really, really was. And I think that brought, and it was so important to have it there at that part of the book, because until that part, I don't think I ever really got the visceral sense of how dangerous and monstrous these horses really are.
Yep.
That they actually come onto land and hunt people and animals and will you know, I mean, there were mentions of it, but until you get the scene, it was just awful.
A bit of culture ignorance here. Seahorses, is this a Selkie thing or what am I?
It's a Kelpie. There's many traditions of it.
Yeah.
Of violent horses that come from the sea and eat people.
Horses that drag their riders into the sea and eat them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. There's ones...
Who comes up with this stuff 2,000 years ago? I mean... It's all right. That's a whole other question.
I've actually got a little bit from Maggie Stavata's website where she's talking about the book and why. It was a book that she had been trying to write for years and years and years and had started several times and abandoned and just didn't know how to do it. She wanted to write about the water horses. It was something she was sort of a little obsessed with for most of her life, I gather. But she is talking about what the horses do and various myths of them, and she's saying some of them, the horses come onto land and they take the guise of beautiful young men to seduce women back into the ocean. So it's sort of the Selkie thing but reversed. There's some of them when they come on and they become cute little ponies and entice children onto their backs and then take them into the ocean.
And then eat the children.
Well, there's they just take them into the ocean.
Okay.
Yeah. And she said one of her favourites was one of the folk tales where the horse comes onto land and becomes a cute pony and entices children but entices more and more children and he just grows in length like some kind of carnival, horse. to get more and more children onto his back. And when he has this like backload of children, off he goes into the ocean.
School bus.
Yeah, exactly.
School bus of doom.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things. I mean, human beings, you know, water is a big part of our culture. It always is. Like, water is hugely important. The sea is always there. And horses for many, many, many centuries have been tremendously important to human beings. So when you get, you know, these elements that are such integral part of your culture, it's not surprising that the same kind of stories pop up all over the world in disparate places.
Judaism doesn't have a horse story.
Okay.
No, it really doesn't. I mean, it's got Balaam and Balak and the whole talking donkey thing in the Bible, but which obviously is, you know, great. But it doesn't have horses that eat children drown children in the water. None of that.
Going back to that scene where the water horse comes on land and bails up the main characters. And again, a spoiler, sorry, but an animal is in danger.
Yeah.
And what I liked what Stefano did was that you're, again, filled with dread.
Yes.
The dread is maintained because there's no mention of what happened to that. Well, it's a cat. Okay.
Yeah, it's a cat.
But what I liked was the little... Stefano is also very masterful at creating a flick of hope.
Mm. Yes.
There's these moments where you get this dreadful grimness, this darkness, and then suddenly flick a little light.
Yeah.
And you go, yeah, there is hope for me.
it's a mini release valve, isn't
it?
It is.
Beautifully done and always at the right time.
Yeah.
Well, I think she belongs to a category of writers like Joan Aiken where truly dreadful things happen. It could be very melodramatic, but the characters in the stories are so pragmatic that they just sort of carry on doing what needs to be done. And when I was a kid, that was tremendously important to read books in which, you know, even under dire circumstances, people just kept on doing what needed to be doing and were cheerful about it.
Mm. Yeah.
Kelly, have you read any of her other works? Because she's got a werewolf trilogy.
I was not a fan of Shiver and Fever.
Is that the werewolf?
Yeah, I'm still waiting for my perfect werewolf novel.
Okay. So you wouldn't recommend the werewolf?
You know, a lot of people love those books, but I tried them, and I think her writing is lovely, and I just couldn't engage. Yeah. No.
Did you read Ballad, the fairy?
No, I have not read that yet.
Okay. Mm. I'm just curious.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. Did either Alison or Kelly have anything more to say about this book?
I would love to make two further recommendations, actually, because I had such a hard time choosing.
Yes, certainly.
The other two things that I really thought about recommending, and which are tangentially connected to this, one is Molly Gloss's novel, The Hearts of Horses, which is a historical novel about a woman who's a circuit rider and breaks horses in Oregon, I think. And the other is Isabel Wells's young adult books about a character named Flora Segunda, and she is one of my very favorite writers. And the third book in the trilogy has just come out, and they are extraordinary. I use them to hook people who don't like fantasy.
Okay.
And once you read them, it's like the tent peg, you're converted, you know.
Oh, my God, you're going back to the tent peg.
You go from Flora Segunda to George Martin, you know, without any sort of issue, without qualm.
Yeah. Oh, I think I might have to look those ones up.
Is that also in the books? Yeah. This is like a tent peg?
Oh, stop it.
Well, I just wanted to have a look at
quick. Enough.
It is the theory of how to get people to read fantasy novels if they think they don't like it.
I've already forgotten what Kelly has said, so can you put those on the show notes?
I will put them on the show.
No, because I'll actually use the show notes this time.
Will you?
For myself.
For yourself?
Yes,
I will. I'll put all those books on the show notes.
Thank you.
Okay, well, unless anyone else, you have anything else to say about this book, Ian?
Obviously, I'm wrong about Sean because you all loved him. Maybe I'm not into enigmatic, mysterious guys, but I still loved it, though. And actually, I was tempted to buy one of the first book of the werewolf trilogy, but I was going to actually ask, and now I won't. But no, Maggie, you haven't lost a sale necessarily. Because I am curious about the fairy one, so I'll have a look at that instead.
That's good.
Yeah, that was my last thought.
That's good. So we're recommending The Crystal Singer if you're 14 and in 1985. Or from a more intellectual exercise of reading a book with the context of when it was written. But we all heartily recommend the Scorpio Races if you're any age now.
I assume some of you in the audience have already bought it with your Kindles, right? Yeah. Oh, we've got. Yeah. Wow. I was joking. Really? Just you've really done a buy on it. Well, there you go. Maggie, you got a sale.
Excellent.
Instant.
Excellent.
Our technology, I love it.
No, I do. I love this book so much. I bought it on the Kindle to read. I'm going to go buy a hard copy now because I want it on my
excellent.
Shelf. Yes, definitely.
Actually, yeah, I couldn't bear it to buy it as an ebook because I liked the physical book so much.
Oh, yeah. Well, I buy a lot of the podcast book Ian recommends on Kindle when I can, or just an ebook. I hate that Kindle has become synonymous with ebooks, but anyway, that's another podcast.
I saw it at readings.
I will have to go pick it up because, it is a book that I can see myself going back and rereading.
Yeah, you know you can do that on the Kindle. It doesn't vanish suddenly after you finish. I'm sorry. I don't want to go the whole electronic thing. We can do that.
I want the
when
book,
we do our e-book
book
episode
on my shelf.
In a couple of months, we can have that debate.
I want the book on my shelf, fine. Ian.
Yes.
You know
understood.
Me.
Oh, and she actually, if you go and watch the book trailer for the Scorpio Races,
that's
she
beautiful.
She apparently drew it herself.
Yes, and did the music.
And animated it, yes.
Oh, and she
fabulous.
Did the music as well.
Yeah.
That runs behind
too,
it, yes.
God. Wow. I no longer recommend this book because she's clearly not human.
I know. I will link to that trailer in the show.
Can you guys do? Well, you could create bonnets, Alison. We've sorted that out.
Yeah, yeah.
And Kelly, do you draw or no?
No. No.
Kirsten,
what?
Well, you're a writer. Do you do other stuff that you can, you know, multi? No.
I make jewelry and I do quilling.
Mm. Oh yeah, well that's great.
Ah.
And I critique.
I really should have brought the stick.
Move on.
All right, so we're going to just wrap up and ask our listeners or our audience members to, if you want to send us feedback, you can follow us on Twitter. We are Writer and Critic at Twitter.
Can the feedback not be, I fell asleep halfway through in the audience? I'm sorry, I'll stop. Or that I left after an hour to go to another panel. That's also not. Okay.
You can follow us on Twitter at Writer and Critic. Or you can comment on the website, which is writerandcritic.podbean.com, or email us to writerandcritic@gmail.com, or Ian, what else can they do?
They can give us 5 stars on iTunes, anything less, and it's summary punishment and death. And why would you bother? I just want to say that I've now set up Google Analytics off the Podbean site,
God.
So I'll now know what country you're from and possibly your address. So just keep that in mind.
Which also means that every month I will get the stat reports when he...
The stat badger will provide the reports.
I forgot I called you that. Yes. Stat badger.
It's been tweeted. It's everywhere. My wife started calling me the stat badger last night. I said, well, you weren't even at the convention. It was on Twitter. So,
that's hilarious. Yeah, no, he does. He walks into my house often with his iPad open going, do you know 372 people downloaded the last episode? It's very off-putting.
I am an egomaniac.
It's
We've
very
covered
off-putting.
This.
So, our next episode, this was episode 20. Our next episode is episode 21, by the magic of living in the future. We've already recorded the next episode, which is yay.
Yeah, I know.
Because I get some time off.
We get 2 months off.
So you can listen to it. And it has our wonderful guest, Jonathan Strahan, who left the room earlier because he was so offended by what we were saying about Anne McCaffrey, and we hadn't even gotten to the tent peg.
He knew it was coming.
Hi, Jonathan.
So he had a hot date with the tent peg.
So next month we will and have been talking to Jonathan about a book called Galveston by Sean Stewart, which was his recommendation.
World Fantasy Award winner.
Mm. Yep. And we know what we all thought about it, but we're not telling you. And Ian's recommendation was A Carter Witch by Nnedi Okorafor. And I recommended The Drowning Girl by Caitlin Keenan. And I think it's safe to say that anyone who knows me or has listened to a previous podcast will know how I felt about
Can
that.
Can I give one book. Spoiler for the podcast?
Okay. Isn't it weird being able to give a spoiler?
For a future podcast. I know. The discussion on the Kenan goes on for a long time. It is our longest podcast.
I may
Galactic
edit
Suburbia
it a
did a I don't think you should. Okay. Galactic Suburbia did a 2-hour and 27-minute podcast, which we mock at the beginning of this podcast, episode 21, and then end up going for at least 2 hours and 22 minutes ourselves.
I'm gonna
spy our own petards.
I'm going to make sure when I listen back to that podcast and polish it that it will go for at least 30 seconds less than the Galactic Suburbia 2-hour and 27-minute podcast. I refuse to have the longest Australian podcast ever. So that's it. So thank you, lovely audience, for coming along and listening to two books you may or may not have read. And if you're listening at home, thank you for listening as well. And we'll see you.
And thank you. And,
oh, sorry, yes.
I was waiting for it. Usually I'm the one who forgets that sort of stuff. I rely on.
I'm really not you feeling
really
well.
Last night was terrible for it. Just talk to Jason.
Yeah, sorry. Obviously, wonderful. Oh. Many thanks to our wonderful special guests and guests of Continuum, Alison Goodman and Kelly Link. And thank you for recommending the books, and thank you for coming along and staying awake, as I'm clearly struggling to do.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. And a round of applause.
Okay, so ask the question again.
Did you have any question?
Oh. Do it properly. See what you lovely people get to have because you're here. This is if you're in my dining room every month, this is exactly what you get, but with more sticks and water.